know, the Hogan stuff, it was real bad. I think that what they're going to weigh is how, you know, will people forget? Because when he comes back, the fan base will go crazy for him because it's nostalgia and Hogan's part of their childhood and everything like that. But do they want companies going like, you're putting this guy, you know, as a you know, one of the faces of your company, and he said this stuff, and there's no denying he said it. Everyone knows what he said. And it was really horrible stuff in a lot of ways. So that's kind of like what they have to weigh, and I don't know when they're going to. I mean, I believe they're going to do it, that he'll be back at some point in some form, but it's you know, it's a tough thing because it is a risk of offending the wrong person, and you can't really, it's hard to defend if like some sponsor just goes, this guy said this, and you just brought him back. What do you say? It's like, well, we didn't know it. It's like, no. So I think that's what holds it up.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week, our guest is Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, WrestlingObserver.com, and a writer for MMAFighting.com. No one has covered professional wrestling longer and with a more journalistic bent than Dave Meltzer. Worked for the famed National, and I'm really excited to have him on. I think he's going to be a really, really fascinating guest, and those who follow the WWE and other professional wrestling outlets are more than familiar with Dave Meltzer, one of the big names in that world. Thank you very much for listening to previous podcasts, including Arlo White. We'll have Andy Roddick coming up very, very shortly, and then some college football and NFL people as we head to the fall. But without any further ado, let's bring in Dave Meltzer from California, who, as I said at the top, no one has covered professional wrestling longer and with a more journalistic bent than Dave Meltzer, a very big name in that sport for people who have been reading wrestling content for a long time. I'm very excited to have him on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Dave, good morning from New York City.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Or I should say good afternoon from New York City. It's morning where you are in California.
Yeah.
The Wrestling Observer has chronicled professional wrestling for the past 29 years. I think I have my dates.
Longer than that, for sure. I started in the Observer in 83, but I started writing pro wrestling in 71.
Okay, wow. So yeah, okay. So my apologies for that. So we're talking, you have been chronicling wrestling since the early 70s. Why do you still do it? Why do you love reporting and writing on this?
Oh, geez. I didn't choose it. It chose me. I mean, I started writing about it. I made a decision in 87. So I guess that would have been really the thing where, you know, I was either going to do regular sports writing or wrestling because I was going crazy doing both. And I made the choice of wrestling, which was a choice that everyone I know thought was like absolutely stupid, but it turned out to be the right choice. So that's, you know, I do it because it's my job. And I mean, I like my job, but I do it because it's my job. That's all.
Do you love the content? I mean, I understand you do it and I understand you're good at it, but is it still exciting for you to watch a really, really good professional wrestling bout between two performers?
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, it's a good one. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and an average one, I feel average, and a bad one, I feel like it's no different from covering anything else, movies or sports or music or whatever. I mean, I consider it the exact, you know, pretty much the same thing. I mean, other people may consider it different, but I don't.
What is, I know no week or no days are per se the exact same thing, but to give our listeners just a sense of what your work week is like,
it's insane.
Can you describe what a typical sort of reporting week and writing week is like for you?
No, it's just all day, every day for the most part. I mean, it's, you know, very few breaks. You know, because again, I'm doing not just pro wrestling, but MMA.
Right.
And so it's you know, even if something's like a lot of times Saturdays are not a big day of pro wrestling, but I'm watching 6 hours of UFC almost every Saturday. So yeah, you can never catch up because there's so much pro wrestling. I mean, if I only covered, you know, like WWE, it wouldn't be as difficult. But to me, it's like, if I'm going to cover this, I'm going to know it. And you've got to cover every, you know, if you're not covering the top stuff in the world, then there's stuff that you're learning that I should be learning that I'm not learning. So, I mean, one of the things I was taught very, very early on is that you got to open your mind to as much, you know, variety of content and see what different people are doing in different parts of the world and what's working and what's not working. And if you only look at one company, you're going to get a very narrow viewpoint. And the smartest people in the business are the ones that learn from every company as opposed to just one company. And there's so many companies and there's so many styles all over the world. And, you know, it's impossible to keep up, honestly.
I want to ask you some questions about sort of your reporting process, which is fascinating to me. And I want to break it down between the different elements. We'll stick with wrestling for the moment, the different elements within that sport. How, as a general rule, how forthcoming are the wrestlers?
It depends on the wrestler. It varies. Some of them are extremely honest. Some of them are extremely dishonest. Some don't want to deal with you, and some are, you know, happy to deal with you. My experience, I mean, and there's not even really a rule. I mean, everyone's different.
How forthcoming is management?
That depends on the company. I mean, certainly, like, if you compare it to a real sport, far, far less. In most cases, there are definitely exceptions. There are companies that are extremely forthcoming. But I would say, as a general rule, you know, if I'm going to compare it to MMA and football or something like that, definitely less.
Within this same framework, and this is really interesting to me, how often do people contact you? Meaning a wrestler contacts you, person in management?
Every day.
Okay.
Every day, all, you know, not like all day, but I mean, if you're including email, direct messaging and Twitter, you know, Twitter messaging and texting. Yeah. All day, every day.
And are they contacting you for specific reasons to give you information or for something else?
Sometimes information, sometimes career advice, sometimes just discussion of how things are going in the industry, you know, all kinds of things.
And then what would you say the percentage of how often people contact you versus you actively going out and contacting people?
I don't know. That's hard. Maybe 50-50. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
Maybe it's not, but it's you know, it's probably close to 50-50.
I not too long ago, I heard a podcast with Eric Bischoff. Obviously, wrestling fans know his place in the business and certainly very famous running WCW. And he brought you up, just irregardless of the fact I was going to have you on. It just sort of it was a, sort of a happenstance. And I'm listening to him, and he said something to the effect of, you know, I didn't like the how we were covered during my time, and I didn't particularly like the writers. And I didn't particularly like Dave Meltzer that much, but the one thing about Dave Meltzer was he was always accurate. I may not have liked what he said, but he really cared about accuracy and he cared about reporting. Specific to that, Dave, were you the first, at least in any kind of national level, to approach pro wrestling with kind of a journalistic bent?
I was the first to do it the way I do it, for sure. There were people, I mean, if you look back in the, the 30s and the 20s, I mean, you know, in that era, pro wrestling got tremendous amount of mainstream coverage in the 20s and 30s and in the daily newspapers. And while, you know, and you can kind of, a lot of it was, you kind of had to read between the lines and stuff, but I mean, I have friends who have sent me like clippings, you know, leading into big matches or just, you know, newspaper clippings from different papers. And, you know, they were covering pro wrestling the same in the 20s and 30s as they would cover baseball or other sports. I'd say after the 30s, it kind of went away. Maybe some of that was payola involved as well, but I really don't know, but this, cause some of it did seem like, coverage, you know, some of it was probably coverage bought and paid for in those days, but some of it wasn't. So, you know, I can't say there were some really good, interesting articles about, you know, what was going on behind the scenes back then, but it kind of went away. And then, you know, I would say when I started the Observer in the 80s, that probably brought it back, because certainly in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't really being done at all.
You've talked about, including when you were inducted into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, how you really were not liked by many people, or maybe management particularly in the 1980s. What was that era like for you in terms of reporting on something where clearly management had never seen this kind of stuff getting the light of day?
Yeah, it was really difficult for them because they lived in a weird world, and they still do. I mean, if you really think about it, but less now than then. They were just so used to living in a world without coverage and just thinking that, like, coverage, it's like I think one of the things was when I started watching wrestling, a lot of the promoters didn't even want coverage. Some of them did. Some of them kind of we'd go like, hey, we're doing 10,000 people every other week and nobody will cover us. You know, why don't they cover a Vern Gagne would have that opinion. And the whole argument was, well, you're not sport. But so if that's the case, then the entertainment people should cover you. But the wrestling people didn't want to be entertainment. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a weird thing. And the entertainment people didn't want to cover them, probably even worse than the sports people didn't want to. So they developed a thing where they thought that they were, they were immune to coverage, or if it was. So then when I started covering them, it was something they weren't used to. So it was really tough. I mean, it was, a lot of the promoters at first didn't like it because I was reporting on it as it really was. I wasn't pretending it was real. And a lot of the promoters were just, adamant about the public perception that it was real, even though no one in the public really believed it was. They believed that the public did believe it was. Mm. Vince was the first one to go public and essentially and say, hey, we're it's not real. But Vince was actually, probably the last promoter. By the time I was dealing with Vince, he was like the last one. I mean, everybody else was already talking to me, or in contact with me before Vince. So he was kind of the impression was, I don't know about Vern Gagne, because Vern was fading out by then. But Vince was always the one that seemed, the maddest about it, really. And it was funny because, he was the only one. I mean, I was thinking like, the reason these guys are mad at me and they're not even mad at me anymore is the one thing that you were the first to already go public with. So why are you mad at me type of thing?
Would you get a call like in the 80s? Would like Vince call you at your home or wherever and say, and just start?
Rarely, but, by the late 80s, it wasn't so rare. But it was, I'd say late 80s and 90s, I talked to him, fairly often and occasionally very lengthy as well.
Wow. And eventually we'll obviously go to modern time, but because it's just interesting to me in the 80s and early 90s, was the interest among your readers the same as I would look at sports today, that people want to read about LeBron and stars? Did the people in the 80s want to read about Hogan and Piper and Ric Flair? Was it equivalent, or for your audience, were they a little more nuanced and they wanted, independent wrestlers profiled and people who maybe we didn't see every week on television?
I think the people who came to me wanted to know what was going on behind the scenes. Mm. They wanted to know what was going to happen, why it was happening, who's going to be leaving, who's happy, who's not happy. I covered it very businesslike because business was like, that was really what it was all about. The idea was who put butts in the seats, right. And because that's how the wrestlers made their money. And a lot of the early readership was a lot of wrestlers, because wrestlers were used to there really wasn't good communication. I mean, how different territories were doing, and a lot of it was BS. So, one of the things I always did was, cover the, how many people were attending the matches, because that's what the wrestlers got paid on.
Right.
Is they were getting in those days, the wrestlers were getting a percentage of the gate. And so if a place wasn't doing good business, the wrestlers were starving. If a place was doing great business, the wrestlers were doing really, really well.
Were there any stars of that era who were particularly forthcoming with you, who at least understood how an independent media operation could help them?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, it was more read than contacted me at first. I mean, more subscribed. but didn't talk to me. But there were ones, you know, who talked pretty quickly on. You know, and it would almost be, you could almost figure them based on the ones that were the most into the business. And they would be the ones who would be most likely, reading and discussing and doing extent even teaching me.
What was your relationship like with guys, let's say like Piper and Flair and Hogan at their 80s, 90s hype?
Piper, I didn't really talk to until much later, although I'd met him in California when I was a lot younger. Flair later, not in the 80s, but in the 90s, you know, I knew Flair and Hogan. You know, I've had conversations with Hogan from time to time, but not during the 80s. No. I mean, I take that back. I met Hogan at a TV show when I was in college, but you know, that may have been even right when the Observer was I was already doing the Observer for sure, but it was very early on. But I mean, as far as like, no, not really. I mean, if you asked Hogan if his memory would, you know, he would probably say the first time we met would have been, at a UFC show, I think.
Wow.
I can't remember before. We were at a UFC show in Vegas together and we met then, you know, although I had talked to him before then.
Was the WCW, WWF wars good for business for you? Or if nothing else, was that content interesting to you?
Oh, it was great then. That was actually probably, I will say this, as far as like dealing with management, that was easily the peak because what you had was, I mean, that was a real war and both sides, I mean, the amount of information that I got directly from WWE and WCW was, you know, I mean, they were, you know, I mean, everything. They were both so cooperative in that era because, you know, they were, it was a real war. It was the best thing that ever happened to wrestling. And it's the worst thing that ever happened is that it ended. So that would be what I would, so what was the sense of that rest of the question?
Yeah,
sorry,
basically, like, was that good for your business? Because obviously,
it was actually great for business. Yeah, that was the most. You know, that was when wrestling was the most popular
right.
in my lifetime. Would have been 97 to 01, and absolutely for my business. I mean, it's better. My business is better now, but as far as like growth and everything like that, that was a great period for business. Yes. I mean, And you know, when it ended, you know, my thought was just like, oh man, I mean, it's like, I knew I would survive. I mean, I was never really, at one point I was even worried if I would, because I didn't know if the business would survive at any kind of a big level. Cause WWE started going down really fast
after
a one. So, and they were the only game in town. So it was like, yeah, this thing may get to be a, you know, I mean, there were people who were very, very smart in the business who thought that WWE was going to end up being this thing that like, ran in the United States, never made money, and then made all their money, you know, going on these big European tours, because as a American entity in Europe, WWE always did well in Europe, even when they weren't doing well here. And we were thinking like, yeah, you know, they're going to end up being like not a big thing here, but, and they'll survive based on Europe. And I thought, man, that's not going to be the best thing for business. That was a great period for business. It was a great period for the industry. It was a great period for the wrestlers.
As a journalist, and if you could take each of them individually, I think that'd be really interesting for the listeners. What do you think of Vince McMahon, Stephanie McMahon, and Shane McMahon in terms of just them as business people, as personalities, this is probably a fair thing to say, as cultural icons within sports entertainment?
Well, Vince is a larger than life person. And, you know, he's the best wrestling promoter there's ever been. You know, I mean, he has his hits and his misses and everything like that. When he was in the 80s, I think he was really on the top of his game. He was tremendous building that company, and running everybody else out of business. He had some great advantages over them, but essentially he was ahead of the game. I think that the late 90s thing was a lot more, luck and circumstance. But a lot of it was also Vince McMahon as a performer. In the 80s, he was not a performer. He was a television announcer.
Right.
In the late 90s, he became a performer and he was a key performer. And in winning the war, him and Steve Austin, you know, was the keys to turning that company around when they were losing. And since then, you know, hits and misses. I think that, you know, the fan base has changed. Some will argue for the best, some will argue for the worst. And I think Vince has been very slow to change with it. And I think the, you know, there's definitely been a disconnect between Vince and his fan base in the last couple of years. Vince thinks he knows best, and the fans think they know best. And I'm not sure who knows best, but it's not been, it's been a very, very interesting thing to cover watching it. Stephanie is being, you know, pushed and portrayed. I mean, as the heir apparent, the public face of the company. I think she's great on television usually. But the writers write so much for her. I don't want to say for her ego, but they know where their bread is buttered. And I don't know it's necessarily the best thing for the performers, that the performers are always made secondary to Stephanie, and it's the big bad boss, and the performers are secondary. And I think that kind of hurts the drawing power of the performers. And Shane, you know, Shane left years ago, and now he's back just as a television performer. And people love Shane. So I'll give him that, you know, but I mean, he's not really like working in the business end of the company. He's just a television performer, and he's popular, and as the quote general manager of SmackDown. I mean, Stephanie is the one who's obviously Stephanie and Paul, her husband, are the ones who are, you know, going to probably take over the company. And Paul, you know, does NXT. And I got to say, like, you know, he's done a great job with NXT as far as developing the brand, you know, a brand with no television that's able to get as much interest, you know, like that show that they had Saturday night at the Barclays Center.
Yeah.
That was, you know, they've gone in and it's, you know, they've done some spectacular shows. Now, granted, I think a lot of people could do spectacular shows if you could line up the kind of talent they have. I mean, the talent on that show was tremendous. And I mean, it was not for the most part self-developed talent. It was, you know, Shinsuke Nakamura was, you know, one of the top guys in Japan. Samoa Joe's been one of the top guys. Bobby Roode, these guys have been top guys in TNA, you know, and independent wrestling for years and years. And you bring them in and put them against each other and give them time and promote them well. And I mean, yeah, you know, you're going to have a great show. But he added bells and whistles. You know, Lee England coming in with Nakamura's ring entrance, some of the music and just the presentation and stories. NXT is actually in many ways a better product than WWE.
Yeah, and you could see all the NXT stars who are now have prominent roles in WWE. So that's been an amazing filter.
Well, that's the one thing that saved the company.
I'd
because
agree.
They were running low on stars years ago, and a lot of the stars were aging out. And now, you know, there are stars aging out now, but there's so many guys that are ready to come up that are, you know, that are as good or better than the stars there. So I don't really worry about the talent end of WWE because of they're very, very active now in recruiting guys. I mean, that hasn't really paid off as much as I would have thought. And it'd be really a long thing, but I have my theories as to why. But they've been, you know, heavily recruiting guys. I mean, they've got NFL, ex-NFL players who are great athletes in that system. And I'm sure they'll probably sign up a couple of guys for the Olympics. I know, Gerald Briscoe was in Rio, you know, scouting talent. And I know there's several people, especially women, that I saw that I think could really help the development of their women's division if they can get them.
Right.
And international talent, and they scout, you know, they haven't really been scouting gymnasts, but I think that they should start scouting gymnasts.
That's interesting.
You know, they've got, you know, sometimes weightlifters, the wrestlers, but I think they mainly scout wrestlers and football players.
Man, imagine Simone Biles in the WWE in some role. It'd be fantastic. There are a number of journalistic things I want to get into with you in terms of sort of the modern day coverage. And the first one, before I do that, Dave, actually to change up on this, what is your thought on how Raw and SmackDown have formed these singular brands? SmackDown now live on Tuesday. They have the Stoll storyline with Stephanie McMahon and Mick Foley as sort of one group, and Daniel Bryan and Shane McMahon is another. I check, you know, from my end and what I do, I'm always interested in the ratings of these shows. So that's kind of how I often sort of get a little bit of a pulse of the popularity. But you are in the middle of it, and I imagine you see this probably differently than even a media reporter like myself. So how have you looked at what they've sort of done with these two designations?
Yeah, it was a risk because it felt like when I would watch a 3-hour Raw, there was not enough talent for the 3 hours because the shows would usually drag.
Right.
And then it was just like, now you're going to split it in two, but they did have enough talent to bring up and everything. So far, as far as the Raw ratings go, I haven't seen any difference. So they haven't fallen, but they haven't gained. I mean, they had 2 bad ratings against the Olympics, but I throw that out.
Right.
I mean, but SmackDown, you know, moving from Thursday to Tuesday, going live and having separate storylines, SmackDown is up, you know, is up from, they were doing in the 2.1 millions. And like last week they were 2.7. So overall it's been a plus, and it's, the positive also is that it enables them to focus for more people to be top stars, because if you have like, you know, people are only going to remember, you know, like if you have, let's say, 8 top guys, you have positions for 8 top guys. Well, now with the 2 shows, you have positions for 16. So that's more people that you can merchandise, and it's more people. There's more chances for people to elevate themselves, because a lot of guys, you know, there's a lot of talented guys there that kind of got stagnated because they couldn't get elevated, and some of them still are, but this enables, like, it's enabled Dean Ambrose to be focused on more, AJ to be focused on more. And so it's so far, I mean, like, again, on the Raw side, I can't say it's been a big difference, but on the SmackDown side, it's helped create a few more stars, and the ratings are a little bit up.
How do you look at Brock Lesnar as an entity to be marketed, and beyond that, as sort of a, where can you go with that character if you want to maintain him for a number of years?
Yeah, Brock is a really interesting character. They signed him to this incredible contract when he came off of UFC. And when he walks in, it's very different from everybody else.
Right.
There's an aura and a vibe when he walks in the building with Paul Heyman that nobody else has. Cena's close, but Cena's a different vibe. People believe that he's real, and he is real. And they portray him as real, and they, you know, like, his matches will have blood. Nobody else is allowed to have blood. There's so many things that's different from him. I mean, he's like a different entity onto himself than everyone else. So they basically use him to run through people. And eventually, I mean, the idea always was for Roman Reigns for him to run through everybody, and then Roman Reigns beats him, and Roman Reigns becomes the top guy in the company.
Right.
And they've had that idea for years, and they never pulled the trigger because the crowd doesn't like Roman Reigns, and they're waiting for the crowd to like Roman Reigns before they do this. It's been, you know, it's a quest. You know, Vince thinks that Roman Reigns is the guy, and that's the biggest fight and the crowd completely rejects him as the guy. And, you know, he's every week they put him in positions to get cheered, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's actually the most fascinating thing about the WWE Raw show is what are they going to do? You know, how many, you know, burning buildings is he going to save? And then the people will still boo him anyway,
right,
type of thing.
Right. Is it weird that I feel for Roman Reigns, both the person and the character, because he's in an impossible spot because management obviously has tapped him on the shoulder, yet the fans, it almost sort of at this point is self-fulfilling. You go to a wrestling show to boo Roman Reigns. Maybe you don't even dislike Roman Reigns, but you know that's just sort of the thing to do live.
To a degree, I think people did that more with Cena, in the sense that I don't think people really, well, there were people who disliked Cena because they thought that he represented an era that they didn't like, because so the problem with the fan base, and to an extent even with the company, is the success they had from like 97 to 2001 has now become so nostalgic and so larger than life. And the fan base, you know, again, in 97 to 2001, the average WWE fan on television was 23 years old.
Wow.
Okay. So that's the age when this thing was really, really big. Well, now the average television viewer is, you know, 40, 42 years old. You know, so it's essentially those same fans, and in their mind, it was so much better then. And it was way more popular. In some ways it was better, in some ways it wasn't. So, but WWE always markets that period as like this great period, and it was. So you kind of get this thing that like it was better then than it is now. And John Cena is the representative of now. So a lot of people like reject him, even though the guy works so hard and he's been fantastic for the company. but there's the people who kind of see him as that representative of this cheesy wrestling that they don't like, and it's not like the old days, and everything like that. And then Roman is even worse, because, you know, Cena at least he became the handpicked guy, but he had to go through a lot. He almost lost his job and everything early on because they didn't see what he had,
right?
Which is amazing, but that's another story. But with Roman, I mean, from day one, practically, you know, he had a lot going. Good looking guy, big. They liked the big guy,
right?
Believable wrestling heritage, the whole thing. So he was pretty much handpicked from day one on the roster that he's going to be the guy to replace John Cena. And then when they made the move, the timing of them deciding for that move was like the worst timing for Roman Reigns possible, because the crowd had at that point fallen for Bryan Danielson, or Daniel Bryan. And they had just, and Daniel Bryan was everything that Vince McMahon, and, you know, it's like Vince McMahon probably likes Daniel Bryan, because I don't know anyone who doesn't, but Vince McMahon, you know, in his mind, a guy who's 5'8" and, you know, 185 and not particularly great looking, it's great to have. He's a fantastic wrestler, but he's not the face of your company. But the crowd wanted him to be the face of the company, and he got ridiculously popular. And that's when they decided to make the move for Roman Reigns. So Roman Reigns became this figure of rejection by the crowd, because we want this guy. And now, you know, Daniel Bryan's, you know, not even a wrestler anymore, but it's carried over in the sense that, you know, maybe it was Dean Ambrose, or maybe it doesn't even matter who it was. They just know that when they wanted Daniel Bryan to win the Royal Rumble and Daniel Bryan to win the championship, Vince McMahon wanted Roman Reigns, and he became the teacher's pet.
Right.
And, these fans rejected him for it.
Do you, were you surprised that Seth Rollins was able to kind of carry the company or be the face of the company for the 9 to 11 months that he did? He really turned out to be an incredibly popular heel, at least in my mind, maybe more popular than I ever would have expected.
Yeah, I think that interview wise, he really picked up a lot. I mean, wrestling wise, no, not surprised. I mean, I knew wrestling wise long before he was in WWE, when he was Tyler Black, that he was very, very talented. And it's funny, because when he was in developmental, I remember talking to Dusty Rhodes. This is several years ago, and we were talking about different guys, because Dusty Rhodes was like was coaching in developmental,
right,
and everything.
Right.
And he, you know, we were talking about, you know, like who's going to make it and who's not. And he didn't mention Seth Rollins, and then he did. And it was just kind of like, well, Seth Rollins, he's a fantastic wrestler, but you need more than that. And I think that was for a long time, that was the perception on him. It's almost like grudgingly. Like I think that, like, in developmental, and I've seen interviews with him and everything where he'll talk about it, about how frustrated he was, because he knew he was better than just about anyone on the main roster, and he couldn't even get out of developmental. He was there for years and years. And I don't think that there may have been a thing where he didn't like listening to advice or whatever, but I'm not sure exactly what it was, but he had to go through a tough period for sure, mentally, when, you know, he's sitting there in the minor leagues when he, you know, is a 300 hitter or 350 hitter. So when he finally got up with the Shield, you know, the whole group was earmarked for Stardom, and the decision was made. I think a lot of people thought that Ambrose would be the heel when they did the split.
Mm.
But they went with Seth, who was kind of a surprising pick, but he ended up probably being, I mean, of the three, he's the best of the three. And as a heel, he's better than as a face. But I do think that when he came back from the knee injury, I think they made a mistake, because the crowd really wanted him as a face then, and they immediately, went against the crowd's wishes, and it kind of soft, you know, like you want someone who everyone loves or everyone hates. If it's in the middle, then people kind of don't care,
right?
And they don't know how to react. Cause I saw some Seth matches where they didn't want to boo him because he just came back from the knee injury, but they were taught not to cheer him. So then he was in that struggling middle position, which is really a tough position to be in.
That's interesting. One last one just on some current guys and then some other questions. Are you surprised at how quickly it seems, at least sort of from afar, that Enzo and Big Cass have blown up and become so popular so fast?
Yes. I thought that, you know, like I thought they were great in developmental, and I thought that when they came to the main roster, they were going to be great preliminary show opening acts. You know, like, it's great to open the show with Enzo doing that stuff.
Right.
You know, like a house show. But I didn't know about how upward they could go, and there's still questions in the sense of, how to say it? Like, I don't know if they could be, you know, Enzo's got weaknesses in the ring. He's absolutely phenomenally charismatic talker. And Cass, you know, has the size and they love him, you know, and he's the kind of guy Vince is going to try to push to the top.
Exactly. Right.
But he also has weaknesses in the ring. So I'm afraid, I hope that they don't rush him, because if they rush him, one of Vince's big problems, and I've seen it with, you know, whether Chris Masters, Bobby Lashley, and a lot of other guys like Mason Ryan that nobody even remembers. And if you get a really physically impressive guy and Vince sees him, this is a story like Bobby Lashley is like a great example of this, in the sense of when Bobby Lashley first showed up in OVW, oh my God. I mean, like, this guy, he was a 3-time national champion wrestler. So he's a great athlete, and he's got a body that looked like, you know, he stepped off the Mr. Olympia stage. I mean, this guy was the freakiest looking guy I'd ever seen. And it was just like, and you know, he'd done no pro wrestling. So he's starting at square one. And it was like, I remember, like, you know, when he was in OVW, it was like, oh my God, we got to make sure nobody, you know, Vince never sees this guy, because the minute Vince sees this guy, he's going to bring him to the main roster, and he's going to bring him up too early. He's going to push him too fast. The fans are going to reject him, and he's going to be a failure. And the fact is, this guy's such a great athlete that he could really be great. But, and that's exactly what happened, essentially. I'm not saying he was a failure, because he, you know, but they did push him too fast. And Cass, I have that fear that they'll look at him and just go, well, he's tall and he's got a good body and he talks pretty well, and the people are really like him right now. So let's, you know, push him to the top. But in a 20-minute singles match, especially with the audience now, which is so into, you have to be a good wrestler. You know, I'd rather that they slowly brought him up as opposed to rush him. Cause I think if they rush him, there's a chance of rejection. If they slowly do it, I think that there's a greater chance of long-term success. Cause I mean, Drew Galloway is another one like that, where he was a good looking guy and he's 6'5" and good athlete. And the first thing they did was, when he's 24 years old and a decent wrestler, but not a great wrestler at this point, you know, he became Vince McMahon's chosen one, and they really pushed him down everyone's throat, and the people didn't go for it. Well, now Drew is early 30s. He's a tremendous talent, but he washed out in WWE. They cut him and he went elsewhere. And then he, you know what I mean? He got to show people what he could do, but it's not in WWE, because right. Vince had already given up on him I tried and it didn't work, and he gave up. And that's kind of like what Vince does a lot of times. You know, he'll get this project, he'll fall in love with the project, then when it doesn't work, he'll just give up on it. And sometimes it's because he pushed the guy before he was ready.
Interesting. ESPN, Dave, recently announced a wrestling vertical. A couple things off this. One, do you see them as competition? And two, and I think you noted this on Twitter, do you expect them to cover the underbelly of the sport in any kind of way that we know they are going to cover the narrative and the storytelling of the sport? Because we've already seen the nexus between WWE and ESPN and a lot of very, you know, main roster guys getting a lot of attention on that network.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I kind of went through this on Twitter months ago when they started doing this.
Right.
It's like, I don't have an issue with anyone covering wrestling. I think that ESPN probably should. It's certainly popular enough. There's no doubt. I mean, wrestling, as far as if you categorize it as sport, you know, it's got to be top 10, right? I mean, it's not baseball, football, basketball, hockey, even NASCAR. But after that, you know, you could argue, you know, them or UFC, right?
Yeah,
are pretty much neck and neck.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say, like, if you take Raw and you say Raw draws 3 million people for a show, that's essentially the equivalent, or can be the equivalent, of a Duke North Carolina college basketball game. So just look at it like on that end.
Right, right. Yeah. It's got a very loyal, audience. But I mean, and it's a very, you know, and the audience is very internet savvy and everything like that. It's without a doubt, it's good for business to cover them. You know, to me, you cover them, you cover them like you would cover anything else, and they don't. Will they down the line? Will they evolve into it? Who knows? Right now, do they? No, not. I mean, if you look at what they do, I mean, there's no depth to the coverage. There's no real investigative work to the coverage or anything like that. And again, it becomes a weird thing because, you know, if you're, you know, partners with them, you know, they're not going to like it and all that. But, you know, I think an ESPN could get away with it. But so far, I mean, again, you'd have to hire certain writers because there's only really a certain number of writers in pro wrestling. And there's very, very few who really understand it at that level and would be able to kind of see through. And, you know, they didn't do that. So will it, you know, as far as what it'll morph into, I don't know. But right now, it's what I expected it to be, which is a disappointment to me because I would like them to cover it. I'd like them to cover it, you know, the way you would cover baseball or football or anything like that, because that was kind of like what I did. And they, you know, there's wrestling kind of gets a pass, which is funny because wrestling fans don't see this, but wrestling gets a pass for so many things because real reporters will never cover it because it's beneath their dignity. And the people who cover it so often are fans that don't want to see the negative side of it. So, I mean, if any sport had the problems when it came to premature deaths, and wrestling has cleaned up in recent years that wrestling had, I mean, there would be, it'd be, you know, if football or baseball had the problems that wrestling had 7 years ago or even 5 years ago, it would be, I mean, it just would blow your mind the amount of coverage they'd be before Congress, and sponsors would be revolting and everything. But because it's wrestling, they can kind of get away with it because nobody really looks at it, you know, looks at that aspect of the business.
That's well said. And we'll obviously watch to see what the ESPN coverage becomes. All right. I want to finish up with, we got a lot of questions on Twitter for you when I let people know that you were going to be on the podcast. First up, Dave, what do you make of all the wrestling podcasts out there? Because what's interesting is if you look at the iTunes charts, essentially almost on a daily basis in the top 100, it feels like there's a dozen wrestling podcasts. They all do well, whether it's JR or Cheap Heat or Bischoff, et cetera. People are really into the content, and there's no way anybody, maybe other than you, would have predicted that 15, 20, 10 years ago. But that is something that just strikes me of how many popular wrestling podcasts there are. What do you make of that?
Well, for years and years and years, wrestling was undercovered. So this is kind of like the bounce back of that. I mean, it was the same thing though, where I used to go, it used to freak me out in the 80s. I would do, you know, sports talk radio. And, you know, like, I think that I did, what was it? I did like one national show, and when the show was over and the host goes, "You got more calls than anyone, but, we just had like Willie Stargell on, who was like, you know, when I was a kid, you know, superstar in baseball, right? So then you got 10 times as many calls as him." And it's like, what? You know, like that. And it was like, you got more calls than like almost any guest we've ever had. And like the first time I did, I don't even remember what it was called, but it was some internet chat thing, right? And that, you know, it was like the in thing to do at the time. And whatever numbers it was, someone goes, "Oh yeah, you know, you were right. You were like right behind, you were with Karl Malone, and you were behind somebody who was, you know, probably even more famous than Karl Malone. Like, it's the biggest one we ever had." And it's what I think is that because wrestling has been so undercovered that now people just can't get enough of that kind of inside information. And now they're getting it from a lot of different sources, and they're getting it, you know, in a lot of cases from people like, you know, Jim Ross was a key management person. He really has a lot of knowledge of the business instinctive knowledge and knowledge of the business because he was there during a lot of things. Or Austin, you know, who was, you know, I mean, Austin's a really, really smart guy who was the biggest star in the business during the most popular period of our lifetime.
Right.
You know, and you look at guys like that, or Jericho, who's got a lot of knowledge in fields other than just wrestling too, because he's not limited to wrestling. But, you know, you look at some of those guys, or Flair is just an icon of wrestling. And yeah, you know, the people can't get enough. And these guys are talking openly about a subject that for years nobody talked openly about.
Interesting. How often are you at a show? How often do you watch in person?
In person? Let's see. I mean, I go to pretty much most big UFC shows, although I missed this last weekend because there was just so many different events with pro wrestling and that I just didn't want to go this weekend. But I don't travel to pro wrestling shows that much. If they're in the area, I'll go. I go to independent shows, you know, from time to time. If they're in this area, I'll go. And I go to Pro Wrestling Guerrilla in Reseda, California, several times a year because they have the best shows in the country of anyone, including WWE and NXT. Wow. So it's kind of like that's my favorite pilgrimage. There's like this little building in Reseda that holds 400 people. And it's like impossible to get a ticket. I mean, it's like the hardest ticket in the world to get because it sells out in like 1 minute. And the people there come from all over, literally all over the world to Reseda. And we all kind of like, it's almost like I'm starting to know everybody there. And the wrestlers know this. And you've got the best wrestlers in the world. And they work harder there because it's the most discerning fan. So, I mean, that's even better than going to Japanese wrestling. I mean, it's just on a different level. So I go to that. I'm going like in a week to, they're going to have a couple of shows and a couple nights in a row. So I'm going to that. So I go to them, not every show, but I try to go to most of their shows, I don't know. It's kind of like more when the shows are as much as there's not really like a set number or anything.
Do the credential process, is it different or the same as your traditional sports
Completely.
Process? Like, it's not like you go through WWE to get a media credential.
WWE, as far as like if it's a WrestleMania or something like that, I would actually, go through them and get credentials and all that. It would be a similar process. But as far as anyone else, if I'm going to go to Ring of Honor, I'll just call them up and I'll, be there. But it's not like there's a press area or anything like that.
Gotcha.
And PWG, I buy my ticket, I mean... And it's not easy to get that ticket. Take my word for it. I mean, you, the stories of people getting tickets to PWG is that somebody should actually do a story on that. The tickets, let's just say they usually go and say on a Thursday night at 8:00. And so people who I know are sitting there with literally, and this is not an exaggeration. They'll have 5 computer browsers opened up, ready to hit the button, hoping one will get through and then he can order their tickets. And literally anywhere between 1 and 5 minutes, every seat is gone. I mean, like the last one, they had 3 shows and every seat was gone in like 3 minutes. And there's probably a demand from 5 times as many people to get in that minute than tickets are available. And then everyone else is shut out. And then I always hear after, like literally 8:30 on that Thursday night, I'll hear from friends and it's like, well, I didn't get in, I didn't get my ticket.
Hmm. Dave, how do you approach reporting on MMA versus your approach for WWE?
Not that much different, really. It's just a different reporting on MMA now or in recent years when it started getting big, it kind of like hit me in a lot of ways of how far behind the times pro wrestling was. And it's funny because the sports people that do MMA were always critical. And it's like, man, you don't know the world I came from. Yeah. I mean, I love what we get here, but, I cover it. It's a lot from a business standpoint and from a business, realistically UFC and WWE as businesses are extremely similar. I mean, their product is different, even though it's real fighting versus fake fighting, so to speak, but, and one's dramatic entertainment and one's real sport. But they're both in the star making business and they're both in the storyline making business and they're both in the selling fights to people making business. WWE is obviously more popular as a television entity. UFC is obviously more popular as a pay-per-view entity. As far as my mentality on both is as far as coverage is kind of similar. Yeah.
Do you see similarities between Dana White and Vince McMahon or are they in dealing with them totally different entities?
Okay. So I'll just tell you this story. So a couple of years ago, ESPN did a feature on Vince and on WWE backstage. And one of the guys at UFC, this was like, on a Friday. So I was at maybe whatever day it was, but there was a UFC show that Saturday. And one of the top guys in WWE comes up to me and in UFC and his eyes are all big. And he just goes, "Do you see the thing on Vince?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "That's Dana." And I go, "Yeah, I kind of know." But there's differences. I mean, Dana's a lot more of a people person in a lot of ways than Vince is. But there's I think the way they run the companies and everything, you know, as far as like really micromanaging and things like that, there really is a lot of, there's a lot of similarities. I think they're driven in the same way. They both don't sleep much. They're both pretty much wild men in different ways. You know, I have my ups and downs with both. I think there's a, you know, they're definitely not the same person, but I think that the way they run their companies are in a lot of ways is very similar.
As we head forward, Dave, do you see more people like Brock, CM Punk? I mean, Ronda Rousey has obviously not wrestled in the WWE, but she's been part of the show. Do you see more performers morphing back and forth between the two entities?
Not as participants so much. I mean, I could see UFC guys going to WWE, but I don't see WWE guys going to UFC. Brock was a weird case in the sense that, you know, and there are, because fighting in UFC now requires so much, you know, it's like, if it was like 20 years ago, guys were going back and forth, Dan Severn, Ken Shamrock, you know, Boss, you know, a lot of guys went back and forth between the two, but the specialization needed to compete at the high level of UFC. It's just very difficult. I mean, even Bobby Lashley's actually doing both at the same time too, which is almost impossible, but he's somehow doing it. But I don't expect that much, because to be top level MMA guy, you really need to focus on MMA. Now, can an MMA, and to be a great pro wrestler, you have to really focus on pro wrestling. Brock is a weird case. He's just an you know, he's from an athlete standpoint, he's a first round NFL draft choice caliber athlete. He wasn't a football player, but if he had been a football player, you know, I mean, he's just a monster and agile and fast and the whole thing, you know, and a great wrestler and just very aggressive bully and everything. But as far as like, you know, will like occasionally, like I know WWE wanted Paige VanZant at SummerSlam, but you know, she's fighting on Saturday. So it didn't work timing wise, but I know a lot of the pro wrestlers are MMA fans, and a lot of the MMA fighters are pro wrestling fans. So, I mean, as far as like appearances back and forth, I could see that, you know, especially now that Vince and Dana, you know, made the deal for Brock and they made the deal for Ronda. So there's a relationship there. So I could see more of that. But as far as, you know, somebody doing both, I mean, Punk is a weird example. And I don't think there'll ever be another one like Punk, because, you know, he's just a guy. I mean, Punk's just a different guy. And he left WWE on top because he wasn't happy. He's got money and he really wanted to do this. And I think that, you know, in hindsight, if, you know, he always, you know, his thing was, if I grew up when this was on TV, I'd have chosen MMA and not pro wrestling. But it wasn't on TV when he was growing up, so he chose pro wrestling, got very good at pro wrestling, but he really was fascinated by MMA and really just wanted to challenge himself and do it. But, you know, he started at 36, and he was not a great, you know, he had no wrestling background like Brock or a kickboxing background or anything like that. I mean, he was just a guy who was a good pro wrestler. And that transition is just, he was just too old to make the transition. Although I know he's working really, really hard at it. I don't see something like that ever happening again. I mean, UFC did it because Punk was such a big wrestling star and they liked him, and he would go to the shows every time he had a break. You know, I saw him at a couple of you know, MMA shows and everything. I mean, he, you know, he wanted to do it. So it was kind of like they'd go, okay, well, you know, you're a big enough star. It's a novelty. But I just think that when this is all said and done with the benefit of hindsight, I don't think that they'll ever do it again. Just like I don't think there'll ever be another James Toney, Randy Couture match. It was something that you do once, it's done. And then because of how it went, you know, you really don't do something like that again.
Yeah, I like Punk a lot. I wish him the best. I think, again, the toughest thing for him is he just started so late.
That was it. And he's not a super athlete. I mean, which is weird because most of your top pro wrestlers are, but starting late was such a disadvantage. And he may, you know, maybe he'll win. He's trained really, really hard for 2 years at it. I'm sure he's gotten a lot better, but you know, like, you know, MMA now is something that, like, you know, you really need to start in your teens or 20s. I mean, just like whether you're like an NBA, it'd be like, you know, before you, it was different. The competition wasn't as tough, but now it's seriously like somebody who's, you know, on the globe. I don't say the Globetrotters, because Globetrotters are closer to basketball than pro wrestling is to MMA, honestly.
Right.
But it'd be somebody who was, I don't know, like a major league baseball player who was tall, who never played basketball their entire life, but is a good athlete. Maybe not even a good athlete, but at 36 going, you know what? I like the NBA better than baseball, and I'm just tired of baseball. I'm going to go play in the NBA. It's like, you couldn't do it. You know what I mean? And so Punk is getting the chance, but it's just not going to, things like that, I don't see happening again.
All right. We'll finish up with a couple of quick ones for Dave Meltzer, who's given us a lot of time. We appreciate it. A question from a reader was about this idea of technical proficiency in the ring for WWE versus mic skills. I'm someone who has always loved the guys who are great on the mic. I love Paul Heyman, whether it's Piper, people like who can cut a promo to me are just so fascinating. But I mean, as you mentioned earlier in this podcast, Dave, the wrestling fan today, I think, does want a high level of technical proficiency. So can you be an like top flight on one and not the other? Or at this point, in order to be a star, do you really have to have both skills?
There's no set rule, but I think it'd be really difficult to be. It's going to be interesting with Nakamura, because Nakamura is you know, from as far as like in the ring, he's very, very good. As far as charisma, he's the best in the world. You know, he blows everyone away. The only person I can compare him to would be Conor McGregor in UFC.
Wow.
Just a ridiculously charismatic guy. And he speaks English very well for a Japanese guy, but I think that, you know, so much of WWE is built around, as far as being like the top guy, is built around that first segment one, where you're out there for 20 minutes talking. And, you know, I hate segment one. I mean, it's like, I always feel like watching that 20 minutes, like if you got it down to 8, it would be such a great segment, but you drag it out to 20, you know, every week. But, I don't know how well he will do in that 20-minute opening segment, and that's going to be real interesting, because he's got every other quality to be the top guy in the company. But you need that ability to do that. You know, Brock, obviously, because he's got Paul, doesn't need that. But he's the only one, you know, unless they put Paul with Nakamura, which, you know, actually could happen. I actually don't think that's the worst idea there's ever been.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
But yeah, I mean, it's like you get, you know, if you're looking at your top guys, I mean, John Cena is not technically a great wrestler, but he works very hard and he understands how to put together a good match, especially when he's in there with another good guy. I mean, he can deliver and almost always does. Randy Orton, obviously, he's not the greatest talker, but he's good enough. And, you know, in the ring, he's very good. You know, obviously guys like AJ and Seth are you know, Ambrose, those guys are good at you know, Jericho. Kevin Owens. I mean, these guys, yeah, you got both. I think that, you know, you, for the most part, you know, you need both, unless you're an outlier, and Nakamura will be the most interesting one, because he's going to be he'll be the one where we're going to find out if you can be a top guy without the ability to carry a long talking segment.
How do you view the emergence of women over the last 2 or 3 years, from the Diva Championship, Charlotte, Sasha Banks, Paige? It seems like the WWE has made a real commitment to feature women at a high level. Although I think they still, you know, there are still at times too, they put them in absurd situations and ridiculous soap opera narratives. But I think you'd agree with me, Dave. It seems like it's 100 times better than it was 20 years ago.
Well, they barely had women 20 years
right,
ago,
right?
You know, and in that attitude era, it was all about, you know, bra and panties matches and just getting clothes off the women.
Right.
I mean, that's what it was like until, geez, I don't know. I mean, I guess early 2000s, then they kind of toned it down a little bit, but even then it was all about the looks, for years and years and years.
Right, yeah.
And now, yeah, now they're, it's what happened, is, some of the women that they started training and developmental just got attitudes of wanting to, because when they were down there, they were taught to wrestle like girls. Okay. It was a different style and a lot of them didn't like it. And some of them fell by the wayside and got really mad about it and like would talk back and developed reps for having a bad attitude and stuff. because they wanted to wrestle like guys. That, you know, they grew up watching guys wrestle, and they wanted to, you know, or watching Japanese women wrestle, which was even better than the guys, and they wanted to wrestle like that. And they were, you know, no, you wrestle like girls. And so as these women, what happened, I think, really changed the tune would have been in San Jose at WrestleMania 2015, when Charlotte, I mean, and there were matches before that. There were matches on NXT television that started tearing down the house based on wrestling. I mean, there was a Charlotte and Natalya match where Brett and Rick were in the corners. And there were others even before that, but that was a big turning point match. But in San Jose, because Vince is at this one now, this has been the first one Vince was at live, and it was Charlotte and Sasha Banks. And it was fascinating even to me because, you know, NXT is in front of 400 people, and at the time, it's changed, but at the time, there's really like 100 in front of the camera, and they were the ones who were controlling the crowd. So it's like this. So they were, and they were really into the women. Paige was a big hit because Paige looked like a college girl, and these were mostly college guys. It was a great dynamic. So she got really, really popular. And then they started kind of respecting the women. But in San Jose, you had 5,000 people, including Vince McMahon, in the crowd. And the women stole the show. I mean, you had Finn Balor and Neville was the main event. And they had a great match, but but they could not follow Charlotte and Sasha Banks. And I remember being in the crowd that night, and it was nobody knew what the lineup was. It wasn't like the lineup was advertised. It was just like NXT is coming to San Jose the night before WrestleMania, and they sold out, and nobody knew if they would or they wouldn't, and they did. So it was the first big, real big NXT show. And they'd already had a women's match before, so people just didn't know. And then all of a sudden, the announcer goes, our next match will be for the NXT Women's Championship. And the whole place exploded. And they came out there, and both women, you know, Sasha was supposed to be a heel then, but they cheered her. They cheered them both. And there was a spot in the match where one of Charlotte's hair extensions fell off in the middle of the match.
Wow.
And I was, if it was a year earlier, or or before, the crowd would have gone, started laughing at him. They would have started whatever, right? They would have just started chanting, you know, oh, fake hair, right? Nobody did. They were into the match. The match was tremendous. They, you know, they gave them both standing ovations when it was over. And it was like, right then, it was just like, this fan base is ready for women. And this is a bigger reaction than the women had gotten in years and years and years. It's like, they're ready for this. I mean, and then they really started pushing WWE to do it. I mean, WWE was behind the fans. The fans were first on this one. It wasn't like, you know, WWE is trying to take credit for being visionaries, but it's essentially, I think it dates back to Ronda, you know, when the same thing happened with UFC, but with the difference UFC handled it very differently, but when Ronda became such a big star in a similar type of venue, and it was, you know, not that she's not pretty, but it was really the sport aspect of it that got her over. And I think that was just like, the audience is ready for women athletes, and women can draw. Because the whole stigma on women was always like, well, they'll never draw. They'll never draw. Guys will, you know, they can be like garnish on a card, but you could never main event them. And then when Ronda came in, I heard that so much. I knew that it wasn't, because I'd already seen Gina Carano and Cyborg. And saw that one live. So I knew the potential of women in MMA already. But I remember when that happened, it was just like, oh, Dana's making the worst decision ever. Oh, Dana's so out of touch. Guys are going to walk out in the middle of the match. No one wants to see the women in UFC. And, you know, I mean, what has hindsight taught us, right? You know, Ronda became, you know, from a mainstream standpoint, the biggest star they ever had. And, you know, WWE, because of that, and they were aware of it, you know, they kind of followed suit. And yeah, it's been at first, it was a real growing pains process for the first several months because of how WWE tried to push it. And I think they pushed it real awkwardly. But I think since WrestleMania, when the women had the best match in a lot of people's minds on the show, it's definitely gotten a lot better.
All right. And the final question for Dave Meltzer, and we appreciate you giving us over an hour at this point. And I realize that this question is one we can do an entire podcast on. So I recognize that, Dave, as I ask you that. But one of the interesting things, and at times pretty horrible things, is the WWE / WWF's how they have treated African-American wrestlers via storyline, via bad tropes. It strikes me that things are certainly better today, but you are one who really would be interesting to me on this because you've been there since the 70s. And the stereotypes that pro wrestling used to have with African-Americans was pretty disgusting. And so how have you seen just the evolution of the African-American professional wrestler, just sort of how he and she have been used in storylines and on main cards and where we are today with this in 2016?
Yeah, that's a real long subject. It was, historically it varied by the promoter but they were very, very much, it was a stereotypical role for, you know, when I started in most cases. Now, I mean, I grew up watching Rocky Johnson, who's Dwayne Johnson, The Rock's father, in San Francisco. And he did not really play a stereotypical role at all. I mean, there were a few, you know, he didn't talk the jive or anything like that. He did do the headbutt thing. You know, I mean, every black and Samoan wrestler did headbutts in those days as like a finishing move. So, you know, you had that stereotype for sure.
Right.
But then you had like the real hardcore stereotype era, WWE in the 80s, you know, with JYD and stuff like that. You know, I mean, the JYD, you know, but, you know, you couldn't do that now because there's too many people watching and too many people who would, you know, complain about if they did what they did, you know, then now. So, you know, it's still, I think that it's always been, for most promoters, it's always still been about who would draw and what they perceive the audience wants and how the audience reacted. I mean, I think there's this thing that a lot of people like that weren't around think that like, oh, you know, all the wrestling promoters used to be racist. And, you know, there were racist words that were part of the lingo of professional wrestling when I was a kid, but I don't necessarily know that racist, you know, I mean, as far as like they didn't hold people back based on race if they thought they could make money with them, but they used them in a way they thought they could make money with them. And sometimes it was demeaning for sure. And a lot of times it wasn't. You know, I mean, like you look back and I mean, I can see like, there's been very few African Americans in high positions of power, booking and everything like right. that. There've been a few, but you know, now I think what we have is, with WWE is they need, you know, I think the mentality is we need diversity. And perfect example, SmackDown with David Otunga as an announcer. It's like, you know, he's learning on the job. I'll give him that. But he's not ready for the job, but they have to have, you know, they have to have an African-American announcer. They have to have an African-American on every panel and things like that, or most panels. It's like, it's like, that's kind of like where it is on that aspect. I think that they feel that they have to do that. And, you know, Byron Saxton's okay. He's not the best. But Otunga obviously is not ready for the position that he's in. And there's much better announcers elsewhere than him, you know, cause he's just learning anyway. And So you've got that aspect there. As far as like, you know, the characters and everything, you know, I think that it's important to them to have characters of all ethnicities on the show. I think they believe that, especially like, you know, they've been for years just, you know, trying to get that, like, you know, more Hispanic than anything, because everyone knows Hispanic's the emerging market. And WWE has wanted that Hispanic superstar since Eddie Guerrero passed away. And to an extent, you know, Ray was always the guy, but he was also too small
right.
for Vince. And they really wanted to go with Del Rio because he's tall, good looking, but it just, he never fully clicked. And then they gave up. He was another one where they gave up on. And so they're always looking for that. They wanted it with Carlito, but he wasn't the right guy. And he's Puerto Rican. And they're still like searching. I mean, it's like one of those things, you know, they want that. They want some 6'2" guy who basically they want a guy who looks like Del Rio, but is, you know, instead of being 39 is like 24, and they haven't been able to find him to who they can build to be, you know, a guy who, you know, like, can be their Hispanic, Roman Reigns, I guess, is right. what I guess I'm looking for. Yeah.
And then finally, as we get you out of here, Hulk Hogan, well, does he eventually make a return to the WWE?
I think so. You know, time heals all wounds. The fans want it, but you know, it's just a game of not offending sponsors, I think, more than anything else. And you know, the Hogan stuff, it was real bad.
Right.
I mean, I thought it, you know, so I think that what they're going to weigh is how, you know, will people forget? Because when he comes back, the fan base will go crazy for him because it's the nostalgia and Hogan's part of their childhood and everything like that. But do they want companies going like, you're putting this guy, you know, as a public figure, is kind of like a face, you know, one of the faces of your company. And he said this stuff, and there's no denying he said it. Everyone knows what he said. And it was really horrible stuff in a lot of ways. So that's kind of like what they have to weigh. And I don't know when they're going to, I mean, I believe they're going to do it, that he'll be back at some point in some form, but it's, you know, it's a tough thing because it is a risk of offending the wrong person. And you can't really, it's hard to defend if like some sponsor just goes, this guy said this, this, and this, and you just brought him back. What do you say? It's like, well, we didn't know it. It's like, no. So I think that's what holds it up.
Yeah, I agree with you. First of all, I think he's going to come back. And second of all, I think they got to figure out how to sort of do that, if they can do that, because that is the issue. All right. Dave Meltzer has given us way too much time. He is the editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter and WrestlingObserver.com. He's a writer for MMAFighting.com. And as I said at the top, he is the most well-known and I would say respected journalist who is covering professional wrestling, worked for the National. Of course, my former colleague, Frank DeFord, who put Dave in a position at the National nobody had done before. And these guys were way ahead of the curve. So I'm psyched. Yeah. I'm very happy that, you know, Dave, that, you know, success found you then and the company still continues and you're really doing exceptional work. I could talk about this for hours, but my producer, Alan Kim, at this point is ready to kill me. So we must end it. So Dave, listen, continued success. And thank you so much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard. I really enjoyed this.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up. My thanks so much to Dave Meltzer, who gave us close to, I think, 80 minutes for the podcast. I literally can talk about this forever. I find that world fascinating journalistically. Dave Meltzer has covered it like essentially nobody else. He covers it like the New York Times or the Washington Post cover the White House. So he's just been a really interesting figure in that sport on a media end. So we really thank him for his time and, you know, follow him on Twitter and check out his stuff if you don't know him. But, you know, any wrestling fan who's listening to this will obviously know who Dave Meltzer is. My thanks to Alan Kim, my producer. Podcasts coming up include Andy Roddick. And as we head forward, we will do both the NFL and college football media people. My thanks to Ryan Hunt, Chris Stone, John Wertheim, Ben Eagle, and Marston and everyone else who does podcasts at Sports Illustrated. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.